sneakers. But Robbie points to the mattress on the floor. He grins, slowly unbuckling his belt, drops his jeans. "Lie down," says Robbie. "This is interesting enough for me. Another thing. We want a sense that an important character, like a narrator, is reliable. We want to believe that a character is not playing games or being coy or manipulative, but is telling the truth to the best of his or her ability. Unless a major characteristic of his or hers is coyness or manipulation or lying. We do not wish to be crudely manipulated. Of course, we enter into a work of fiction to be manipulated, but in a pleasurable way. We want to be massaged by a masseur, not whapped by a carpet beater. That brings us to the matter of how we, as writers, tell the truth. A writer paradoxically seeks the truth and tells lies every step of the way. It's a lie if you make something up, but you make it up in the name of the truth, and then you give your heart to expressing it clearly. You make up your characters, partly from experience, partly out of thin air of the subconscious, and you need to feel committed to telling the exact truth about them, even though you're making them up. I suppose the basic moral reason for doing this is the golden rule. I don't want to be lied to. I want you to tell me the truth, and I will try to tell it to you. One final reminder. You probably won't know your characters until weeks or months after you've started working with them. Frederick Buechner wrote, "You avoid forcing your characters to march too steadily to the drumbeat of your artistic purpose. You leave some measure of real freedom for your characters to be themselves. And if minor characters show an inclination to become major characters, as they're apt to do, you at least give them a shot at it. Because in the world of fiction, it may take many pages before you find out who the major characters really are. Just as in the real world, it may take you many years to find out that the stranger you talked to once for half an hour in the railroad station may have done more to point you to where your true homeland lies than your priest or your best friend or even your psychiatrist. Just don't pretend you know more about your characters than they do, because you don't. Stay open to them. It's tea time, and all the dolls are at the table. Listen. It's that simple." Plot. Plot is the main story of your book or short story. If you're looking for long, brilliant discussions of plot, E.M. Forster and John Gardner have written books in which they discuss it so lucidly and wisely that they will leave you howling like a wolf. I just want to add a few thoughts here, things that I pass on to my students when they seem especially bitter and confused. Plot grows out of character. If you focus on who the people in your story are, if you sit and write about two people you know and are getting to know better day by day, something is bound to happen. Characters should not, conversely, serve as pawns for some plot you've dreamed up. Any plot you impose on your characters will be onomatopoetic. Plot. I say don't worry about plot. Worry about the characters. Let what they say or do reveal who they are and be involved in their lives and keep asking yourself now what happens. The development of relationship creates plot. Flannery O'Connor in Mystery and Manners tells how she gave a bunch of her early stories to the old lady who lived down the street, and the woman returned them saying, "Them stories just gone and shown you how some folks would do." That's what plot is. What people will up and do in spite of everything that tells them they shouldn't, everything that tells them that they should sit quietly on the couch and practice their lamas or call their therapist or eat until the urge to do that thing passes. So, focus on character. What happens in Faulkner's books, for instance, arises from the nature of his characters, and even though his characters are not necessarily people you want to date, they compel us because we believe that they exist and we believe that the things they do are true to who they are. We read Faulkner for the beauty of his horrible creations, the beauty of the writing, and we read him to find out what life is about from his point of view. He expresses this through his characters. All you can give us is what life is about from your point of view. You're not going to be able to give us the plans to the submarine. Life is not the submarine. There are no plans. Find out what each character cares about in the world, because then you will have discovered what's at stake. Find a way to express this discovery in action, and then let your people set about finding or holding on to or defending whatever it is. Then you can take them from good to bad and back again, or from bad to good, or from lost to found. But something must be at stake, or you will have no tension and your readers will not turn the pages. Think of a hockey player. There'd better be a puck out there on the ice, or he's going to look pretty ridiculous. This is how it works for me. I sit down in the morning, and I reread the work I did the day before. And then I wool gather, staring at the blank page or off into space. I imagine my characters and let myself daydream about them. A movie begins to play in my head, with emotion pulsing underneath it, and I stare at it in a trance-like state until words bounce around together and form a sentence. Then I do the menial work of getting it down on paper, because I'm the designated typist, and I'm also the person whose job it is to hold the lantern while the kid does the digging. What is the kid digging for? The stuff. Details and clues and images, invention, fresh ideas, and intuitive understanding of people. I tell you, the holder of the lantern doesn't even know what the kid is digging for half the time. But she knows gold when she sees it. Your plot will fall into place as, one day at a time, you listen to your characters carefully and watch them move around doing and saying things and bumping into each other. You'll see them influence each other's lives. You'll see what they're capable of up and doing, and you'll see them come to various ends. And this process of discovering the story will often take place in fits and starts. Don't worry about it. Keep trying to move the story forward. There will be time later to render it in a smooth and seamless way. John Gardner wrote that the writer is creating a dream into which he or she invites the reader, and that the dream must be vivid and continuous. I tell my students to write this down, that the dream must be vivid and continuous because it is so crucial. Outside the classroom, you don't get to sit next to your readers and explain little things you left out or fill in details that would have made the action more interesting or believable. The material has got to work on its own, and the dream must be vivid and continuous. Think of your nightly dreams. How smoothly one scene slides into another. How you don't roll your closed eyes and say, "Wait just a minute, I've never shot drugs with Rosalind Carter, and I don't even own any horses, let alone little Arabians the size of cats." You mostly go along from scene to scene simply because it's all so immediate and compelling. You simply have to find out what happens next. And this is how you want your reader to feel. You may need someone else to bounce your material off of. Probably a friend or a mate. Someone who can tell you if the seams show, or if you've lurched off track, or even that it is not as bad as you thought, and that the first 100 pages do, in fact, hold up. But by all means, let someone else take a look at your work. It's too hard always to have to be the executioner. Also, you may not be able to see the problems, because in finding your characters and their story, you are trying to describe something by feel and not by sight. So find someone who can bring a colder eye and a certain detachment to the project. I had a friend named Al, who every so often took other people's cats to the pound to be put down because his friends couldn't bear to do it themselves. They were cats who were, for one reason or another, like sickness or incontinence, a blight on the landscape. He didn't care one way or the other about cats. He had an imaginary company whose business was having cats put to sleep, whose slogan was, "The pussy must pay." Let someone do this with your manuscripts. Help you get rid of the twists in the plot that are never going to work, no matter how hard you try or how many passes you make at it. If I tell 30 students to write me a story about two married people who are considering divorce until something unforeseen happens, they'll give me 30 wildly different stories, because they will have 30 different personal histories and sensibilities. One person is going to write an epiphany story, where the wife sees some wild geese pass in the night, lit by the moon, and suddenly decides to give her husband another chance. Another person is going to write about the moment when the husband, on his morning run, first comes to believe his marriage is worth saving, and then is jogging home to share the good news with his wife when he gets hit by a student driver. Another will set the story in Hollywood, because he's been reading Nathaniel West recently, and it will be Jewel-like in its weirdness. Each writer will come up with his or her own description of what love and life are all about. Some of these descriptions will be cynical, some rueful, some full of hope. Some will be slow and interior, some will crackle with drama. Drama is the way of holding the reader's attention. The basic formula for drama is setup, build-up, payoff. Just like a joke. The setup tells us what the game is. The build-up is where you put in all the moves, the forward motion where you get all the meat off the turkey. The payoff answers the question, why are we here anyway? What is it that you've been trying to give? Drama must move forward and upward, or the seats on which the audience is sitting will become very hard and uncomfortable. So, in fact, will the audience. And eventually the audience will become impatient, disappointed, and unhappy. There must be movement. You need to be moving your characters forward, even if they only go slowly. Imagine moving them across a lily pond. If each lily pad is beautifully, carefully written, the reader will stay with you as you move toward the other side of the pond, needing only the barest of connections, such as rhythm, tone, or mood. Now, you may have to use effects and tricks to move things along and to help us remember who each character is. Give him a cigar. Give her piggy little alcoholic eyes. But if you're faking it, it will show. If you knowingly fake something to get the plot to move forward, if, for instance, you have taken a character you don't understand and given her feelings you don't really feel because you want the plot to work, you probably won't get away with it. The reader will stop trusting you and will possibly even become bitter and resentful. These are the worst possible things for a reader to become. You must assume that we, your readers, are bright and attentive, even if we have lost the tiniest bit of ground in the last few years. So we're going to catch you if you try to fake it. If you realize that you've done this, you need to stop and look at your characters again. You've got to go into these people. And since you don't know them, this means that you need to go into you. Wonderful you, who has so many problems and idiosyncrasies. You, who will be able to figure out what is true for these people, and hence what they would or would not do in a given situation. I read a wonderful passage in an interview with Carolyn Choate, the author of The Beans of Egypt, Maine, who was discussing rewriting. I feel like a lot of time my writing is like having about 20 boxes of Christmas decorations, but no tree. You're going, where do I put this? Then they go, okay, you can have a tree, but we'll blindfold you and you've got to cut it down with a spoon. This is how I've arrived at my plots a number of times. I would have all these wonderful shiny bulbs, each self-contained with nothing to hang them on. But I would stay with the characters, caring for them, getting to know them better and better, suiting up each morning and working as hard as I could, and somehow, mysteriously, I would come to know what their story was. Over and over, I feel as if my characters know who they are, and what happens to them, and where they've been, and where they will go, and what they're capable of doing. But they need me to write it down for them, because their handwriting is so bad. Some writers claim to know what the climax is early on, well before they get anywhere near it. The climax is that major event, usually toward the end, that brings all the tunes you've been playing so far into one major chord, after which at least one of your people is profoundly changed. If someone isn't changed, then what is the point of your story? For the climax, there must be a killing or a healing or a domination. It can be a real killing, a murder, or it can be a killing of the spirit, or of something terrible inside one's soul, or it can be a killing of the deadness within, after which the person becomes alive again. The healing may be about union, reclamation, the rescue of a fragile prize, but whatever happens, we need to feel that it was inevitable, that even though we may be amazed, it feels absolutely right, that of course things would come to this. Of course, they would shake down in this way. In order to have this sense of inevitability, The climax of your story will probably only reveal itself to you slowly and over time. You may think that you know what this moment contains, and it makes sense to aim for something, but I recommend that you not fix too hard on what it will be. Fix instead on who your people are, and how they feel toward one another, what they say, how they smell, whom they fear. Let your human beings follow the music they hear, and let it take them where it will. Then you may discover, when you get close enough to peer into the opening, as if into a scenic Easter egg, that your characters had something in mind all along that was brighter and much more meaningful than what you wanted to impose on them. So aim, but not too hard. And when you finally see the climax forming in front of you, then you can race toward it. Lastly, I heard Alice Adams give a lecture on the short story once, one aspect of which made the writing students in her audience so excited that I have passed it along to my students ever since. Most of the time I give her credit. She said that sometimes she uses a formula when writing a short story, which goes A, B, D, C, E, for action, background, development, climax, and ending. You begin with action that is compelling enough to draw us in, makes us want to know more. Background is where you let us see and know who these people are, how they've come to be together, what was going on before the opening of the story. Then you develop these people so that we learn what they care most about. The plot, the drama, the actions, the tension will grow out of that. You move them along until everything comes together in the climax, after which things are different for the main characters, different in some real way. And then there's the ending. What is our sense of who these people are now? What are they left with? What happened? And what did it mean? A formula can be a great way to get started. And it feels so great, finally, to dive into the water. Maybe you splash around and flail for a while, but at least you're in. Then you start doing whatever stroke you can remember how to do, and you get this scared feeling inside you of how hard it is and how far there is to go, but still, you're in, and you're afloat, and you're moving. Dialogue. Good dialogue is such a pleasure to come across while reading. A complete change of pace from description and exposition and all that writing. Suddenly people are talking, and we find ourselves clipping along. And we have all the pleasures of voyeurism because the characters don't know we are listening. We get to feel privy to their inner workings without having to spend too much time listening to them think. I don't want them to think all the time on paper. It's bad enough that I have to think all the time without having someone else dump his or her obsessive, compulsive, paranoid thinking on me, too. On the other hand, nothing can break the mood of a piece of writing like bad dialogue. My students are miserable when they are reading an otherwise terrific story to the class and then hit a patch of dialogue that is so purple and expositional that it reads like something from a childhood play by the Gabor sisters. Suddenly the piece is emotionally tone-deaf and there's a total lack of resonance. I can see the surprise on my students' faces, because the dialogue looked okay on paper, yet now it sounds as if it were poorly translated from their native Hindi. The problem is that the writer simply put it down word by word. Read out loud, it has no flow, no sense of the character's rhythm that in real life would run through the words. In nonfiction, the hope is that the person actually said the words that you have attributed to him or her. In fiction, though, anything goes. It is a matter of ear, just as finding the right physical detail is mostly a matter of eye. You're not reproducing actual speech. You're translating the sound and rhythm of what a character says into words. You're putting down on paper your sense of how the characters speak. There is a real skill to hearing all those words that real people and your characters say, and to recording what you've heard. And the latter is or should be more interesting and concise and even more true than what was actually said. Dialogue is more like a movie than it is like real life, since it should be more dramatic. There's a greater sense of action. In the old days, before movies, let's say before Hemingway, the dialogue in novels was much more studied, ornate. Characters talked in ways we can't really imagine people talking. With Hemingway, things began to terse up. Good dialogue became sharp and lean. Now, in the right hands, dialogue can move things along in a way that will leave you breathless. There are a number of things that help when you sit down to write dialogue. First of all, sound your words. Read them out loud. If you can't bring yourself to do this, mouth your dialogue. This is something you have to practice, doing it over and over and over. Then, when you're out in the world, that is, not at your desk, and you hear people talking, you'll find yourself editing their dialogue, playing with it, seeing in your mind's eye what it would look like on the page. You listen to how people really talk, and then learn little by little to take someone's 5-minute speech and make it one sentence, without losing anything. If you are a writer, or want to be a writer, this is how you spend your days. Listening, observing, storing things away, making your isolation pay off. You take home all you've taken in, all that you've overheard, and you turn it into gold. Or at least you try. Second, remember that you should be able to identify each character by what he or she says. Each one must sound different from the others. And they should not all sound like you. Each one must have a self. If you can get their speech mannerisms right, you will know what they're wearing and driving and maybe thinking, and how they were raised and what they feel. You need to trust yourself to hear what they are saying over what you are saying. At least give each of them a shot at expression. Sometimes what they're saying and how they're saying it will finally show you who they are and what is really happening. Whoa, they're not going to get married after all. She's gay and you had no idea. Third, you might want to try putting together two people who more than anything else in the world wish to avoid each other. People who would avoid whole cities just to make sure they won't bump into each other. But there are people out there in the world who almost inspire me to join the government witness protection program just so I can be sure I will never have to talk to them again. Maybe there is someone like this in your life. Take a character whom one of your main characters feels this way about, and put the two of them in the same elevator. Then let the elevator get stuck. Nothing like a supercharged atmosphere to get things going. Now, they both will have a lot to say, but they will also be afraid that they won't be able to control what they say. They will be afraid of an explosion. Maybe there will be one, maybe not, but there's one way to find out. In any case, good dialogue gives us the sense that we are eavesdropping, that the author is not getting in the way. Thus, good dialogue encompasses both what is said and what is not said. What is not said will sit patiently outside that stuck elevator door, or it will dart around the character's feet inside the elevator like rats. So let these characters hold back some thoughts and, at the same time, let them detonate little bombs. If you're lucky, your characters may become impatient with your inability while writing dialogue to keep up with all they have to say. This is when you'll know that you're on the right track. Dialogue is the way to nail a character. So you have to work on getting the voice right. You don't want to sit there, though, trying to put the right words in their mouths. I don't think the right words exist already in your head, any more than the characters do. They exist somewhere else. What we have in our heads are fragments and thoughts and things we've heard and memorized, and we take our little rag bag and reach into it and throw some stuff down, and then our unconscious kicks in. For instance, say you have a guy walking down the street, and it's cold, and you've always wanted a leather top coat, so you give him one. Then you follow him down the street. Describe what you see and listen carefully. Say this boy meets a girl. The boy in the leather overcoat meets the beautiful girl with the hair lip and the Gucci bag on the street. And he can't just say, "Hey, let's get married." Things need to happen. They need to get to know each other, even if just a little. They will talk to each other and they will talk about each other to friends. Get all this down. After you spend a while with them, they will start to sound more like themselves because you are getting to really know them, and you may see that you'd better get rid of that top coat, it's pretty jive, and that you need to go back and redo the early dialogue. But don't stop and do it just now. Keep moving. Let them spend some time together. Let them jam for a while. Come back later for the rewrite. The better you know the characters, the more you'll see things from their point of view. You need to trust that you've got it in you to listen to people, watch them, and notice what they wear and how they move, to capture a sense of how they speak. You want to avoid at all costs drawing your characters on those that already exist in other works of fiction. You must learn about people from people, not from what you read. Your reading should confirm what you've observed in the world. As you learn who your characters are, compassion for them will grow. There shouldn't be just a single important character in your work for whom you have compassion. You need to feel it even for the villain. In fact, especially for the villain. Life is not like formula fiction. The villain has a heart, and the hero has great flaws. You've got to pay attention to what each character says, so you can know each of their hearts. Only in the comics and formula movies do we get any pleasure from destroying totally evil and sinister villains, because in those cases, they've been systematically depersonalized. They commit only acts of atrocity and sociopathology, and they say terrible evil things, and then we get to ritually kill them. There can be, at the end of the book, the relief that comes with justice. You can't write down your intellectual understanding of a hero or villain and expect us to be engaged. You probably have got to find these characters within the community of people who live in your heart. For instance, just to mix media for a moment, if Anthony Hopkins in The Silence of the Lambs hadn't had an emotional understanding of Hannibal Lecter's heart, his mannerisms would not have rung so true or been so terrifying. The first time we see him, he's simply standing there, expressionless, with his arms by his side. It is just chilling. I felt like I might break out in welts from sheer anxiety. I felt like my neck had developed a life of its own and was going to wait for me out in the lobby. To have this effect on us, Hopkins must have sympathized with something inside Lecter, must have understood something about his heart. The writer needs to try to understand each of his or her characters in this way. The only thing to do when the sense of dread and low self-esteem tells you that you are not up to this is to wear it down by getting a little work done every day. You really can do it. Really can find these people inside you and learn to hear what they have to say. For example, let's say you have a main character whose feelings can be hurt if he's spoken to sharply. Unlike you, ha ha ha. Say he is also a little like you, in the sense that when he gets a bit depressed or tense, he heads for a rib joint to eat a pound of burned fatty meat. So he is perhaps also a little overweight. Not that you are overweight. I'm sure your weight is just fine. Anyway, let's make him someone who works in an office, someone who's been pampered. What could he say that lets us see this? Let's dress him carefully, because we may have to humiliate him in a minute. For instance, we can see by the precision of the knot in his tie that his wife tied it this morning. His clothes and ring and shoes are all going to talk, and they are going to help us find out who he is. But, more importantly, he's going to say things to his secretary and to his callers and to the people with whom he works. And these people are going to say things back to him. And we want to hear both sides of these conversations. What if the boss says something to him that seems innocuous, but that cuts him to the quick? And what if this time he responds in a completely different way than heading out for barbecue? What if he starts saying things that have nothing to do with what you had in mind, and it all mysteriously rings true? What if he says something so insulting to his boss that it puts his job in jeopardy? And then, instead of a little assault eating, he responds by spending his entire lunch hour at an adult bookstore. Well, maybe you had him wrong to begin with. Maybe he goes from being an Ivy League lawyer to a semi-successful rug salesman in two lines of dialogue. This may not be convenient for you, but at least now you can see with whom you're really working. Now I want to hear how he describes his day to his wife. What he leaves in and how he says it and what he neglects to mention. So you make an attempt at capturing this by trying to find him in your psyche, this person who has been talked down to, whose skin is a little thin, whose feelings are easily hurt. You write a shitty first draft of it, and you sound it out, and you leave in those lines that ring true and take out the rest. I wish there were an easier, softer way, a shortcut, but this is the nature of most good writing, that you find out things as you go along. Then you go back and rewrite. Remember, no one is reading your first drafts. I need to digress again for a minute. You create these characters and figure out little by little what they say and do. But this all happens in a part of you to which you have no access, the unconscious. This is where the creating is done. We start out with stock characters, and our unconscious provides us with real, flesh-and-blood, believable people. My friend Carpenter talks about the unconscious as the cellar where the little boy sits, who creates the characters, and he hands them up to you through the cellar door. He might as well be cutting out paper dolls. He's peaceful. He's just playing. You can't will yourself into being receptive to what the little boy has to offer, and you can't buy a key that will let you into the cellar. You have to relax and wool gather and get rid of the critics and sit there in some sort of self-hypnosis, and then you have to practice. I mean, you can't just sit there at your desk drooling. You have to move your hand across the paper or the keyboard. You may do it badly for a while, but you keep on doing it. Try to remember that to some extent, you're just the typist. A good typist listens. I sometimes imagine that instead of a little kid, there's a long-necked, good-natured Dr. Seuss character down there, grim with concentration and at the same time playing. He cranes his head toward the sound of the characters talking, but not like a court reporter, more like somebody sitting alone at an adjacent table, trying not to pry but wanting to take it all in. You may want to come up with an image or a metaphor for this other part of you that is separate from your rational conscious mind, this other person with whom you can collaborate. This may help you feel less alone. One last thing. Dialogue that is written in dialect is very tiring to read. If you can do it brilliantly, fine. If other writers read your work and rave about your use of dialect, go for it. But be positive that you do it well, because otherwise it is a lot of work to read short stories or novels that are written in dialect. It makes our necks feel funny. We are, as you know, a tense people, and we have a lot of problems of our own without you adding to them. However, someone behind me in line at the market last week, during a storm, said, after smiting her own forehead, "Oh, wat weder," and then pointed outside to the rain. I was tempted for the rest of the day to write an entire novel about her in dialect. Set design. Sometimes you may find it useful to let your characters huddle in the wings without you, preparing for their roles, improvising dialogue, while you set the stage for their appearance. Imagine yourself as the set designer for a play, or for the movie version of the story you're working on. It may help you to know what the room, or the ship, or the office, or the meadow, looks like where the action will be taking place. You want to know its feel, its temperature, its colors. Just as everyone is a walking advertisement for who he or she is, so every room is a little showcase of its occupants' values and personalities. Every room is about memory. Every room gives us layers of information about our past and present and who we are, our shrines and quirks and hopes and sorrows, our attempts to prove that we exist and are more or less okay. You can see in our rooms how much light we need, how many light bulbs, candles, skylights we have, and in how we keep things lit, you can see how we try to comfort ourselves. The mix in our rooms is so touching. The clutter and the cracks in the wall belie a bleakness or brokenness in our lives, while photos and a few rare objects show our pride, our rare shining moments. As the photographer Catherine Wagner has pointed out, these rooms are future ruins. So you sit there at your desk trying to see what the set looks like that your characters will be entering in a moment. Perhaps they have money, and you don't. Not, of course, that you're bitter about this. You may need to call one of your friends or relatives who has or had a great deal of money and ask them as tactfully as possible to help you design a house where some old gentry lived. By tactfully, I mean that you're going to get the best possible information if you do not mention life's unfairness and that your own house looks more like God's little acre with every passing day and that you may have to put the dog to sleep because you can't afford to feed her. You just say, I'm working on a section of my book where we first meet a family of great wealth and breeding, and I was wondering if I could pick your brain about what sort of carpets and rugs and lighting and antiques they might have. For instance, let's start with the living room. Can you describe a really lovely living room in as much detail as possible? And then you can ask what smells your friend remembers in the living room and kitchen, and what the light was like, and what various rooms sounded like, or what their silence has felt like. Or by the same token, you can ask someone who grew up in poverty to give you an exact description of his or her house, the kitchen, the bedrooms, the couch in the backyard. Years ago, I was working on a novel that involved a woman who gardened, who in fact loved to garden. I do not love to garden. I love other people's gardens, and I like cut flowers. I have astroturf and a whole lot of high-quality plastic flowers stuck in the dirt of our front yard. These are quite a lovely sight and bring to mind many E.E. Cummings poems. People used to give me potted plants and trees, and what happened to them is really too horrible to go into here. They'd end up looking like I watered them with Agent Orange. I'd tell people that I didn't do well with potted plants, and they'd decide that I'd just never met the right one and that they were going to be the person to free me and cause God to restore my glorious gift of sight and all that, and they'd bring me some little training plant, and I'd try really hard to water it and keep it in or out of sunlight, whatever its little card of introduction said it preferred, and to take it for little walks around the house, and within about a month, you could almost hear chlorophyllis breakdown. A panic in Needle Park sort of thing. Then you'd see it clutching its little throat, staring at you with its little keen eyes, gasping and accusing, and I mean, who needs it? Believe me, I have enough problems as it is. I actually kept this one horrible plant alive for months, this huge potted thing. I don't even know what it was, but it was about 3 feet tall before its decline and green in a sort of fake jolly way. I watered it, I cut off its dead leaves, and how did it repay me? By becoming Howard Hughes in his last days. It lost all this weight. It stopped going out. I came to believe that it would be requesting latex gloves soon, boxes of them, and boxes of Kleenex with which to cover its food between bites. I gave it water, sunlight, expensive plant food. What was I supposed to do, get it a psychiatrist? So I finally came to my senses, took it outside, and put it against the side of the house where I wouldn't have to look at it. You are probably thinking that it immediately began to flourish, but it didn't. It died. So, needless to say, when it came to design a garden for my main character, I wasn't going to be able to plumb the depths of my own gardening experience. But I just knew, somehow, without being able to explain the process to you, that this main character gardened. I love to see people in gardens. I love the meditation of sitting alone in gardens. I love all the metaphors that gardens are. The garden is one of the two great metaphors for humanity. The other, of course, is the river. Metaphors are a great language tool because they explain the unknown in terms of the known, but they only work if they resonate in the heart of the writer. So I felt a little understaffed here, loving the metaphor when I came upon it, wanting to work with it, and yet not loving to garden. I didn't know where to start, but I did know that the garden did not start out as a metaphor. It started out as paradise. Then, as now, the garden is about life and beauty and the impermanence of all living things. The garden is about feeding your children, providing food for the tribe. It's part of an urgent territorial drive that we can probably trace back to animals storing food. It's a competitive display mechanism, like having a prize bull, this greed for the best tomatoes and English tea roses. It's about winning, about providing society with superior things, and about proving that you have taste and good values and you work hard. And what a wonderful relief every so often to know who the enemy is. Because in the garden, the enemy is everything, the aphids, the weather, time. And so you pour yourself into it, care so much and see up close so much birth and growth and beauty and danger and triumph, and then everything dies anyway, right? But you just keep doing it. What a great metaphor. I love this so much. I wanted a garden in my book so badly. Finally, it occurred to me to call a nursery. I reached a very nice man to whom I explained what I was doing, and I asked if he could help me design a fictional garden for someone living in the North Bay with a large backyard. We decided to begin by showing the garden as it would look in the summer, and then he would help me through the months as the seasons changed. "Do you want some fruit trees?" he asked. And then, for the next half hour, we designed a garden full of trees and flowers of every kind. I said I saw in my mind's eye a white latticework screen somewhere in the garden and asked what kinds of vines might go well with that. He suggested snow peas. Then we added some vegetables and a patch of wild strawberries, and I had my garden. I got into the habit of calling him every few months to check in. What would the apple tree be doing, I'd ask. Would there be fruit or even leaves, and what would I do to take care of the flower beds now? I also started going to people's gardens, asking them what this or that plant was and how they take care of it, and they'd say funny or brilliant things, and I'd steal their lines. I picked up a book on gardens, so I could study flowers and trees and vines in that way, and honest to God, people who read my novel believed that I loved to garden. Sometimes, in fact, they would start talking shop with me, thinking we could jam away as gardeners are wont to do, until I'd let them know that I had only been winging it with a lot of help from people around me, people who knew a lot more about gardens than I, friends who would cover for me, just like in real life. "You don't love to garden?" they'd ask incredulously, and I'd shake my head and not mention that what I love are cut flowers, because this sounds so violent and decadent, like when Salvador Dali said his favorite animal was filet of sole. And in the years since, I have asked all sorts of people to help me design sets. I've asked them to describe what the world looked like in certain American cities or African villages, inside a particular car in the rain, or down by the water when hobos still came to town on the train. Then I try to imagine the movie set of this scene in as much detail as possible. Sometimes I can see it most clearly if I close my eyes. Other times I stare off into the middle distance, like a cat. False starts. I talked earlier about the artist who is trying to capture something in one corner of his canvas, but keeps discovering that what he has painted is not what he had in mind. He keeps covering his work over with white paint each time that he discovers what it isn't, and each time this brings him closer to discovering what it is. This has happened again and again for me in writing. I may think I know who a certain character is or how an essay should proceed, so I make a stab at following this ghostly blueprint in my head. Then it turns out that I've been wrong about the character. I had the sandwich board she was wearing confused with who she really is. So I white it out and try again. I found out something important about false starts when I began accompanying some members of my church to a convalescent home once a month, where we were conducting a worship service. At that first dismal visit, I thought I knew who the residents were and what they were capable of, what they were all about. If I had started to write, I would have written about them with confidence, and I would have been all wrong. I've been going there for 4 years now. I don't ever really look forward to it, but I keep going back for reasons I do not quite understand. Perhaps I'm subconsciously hoping it will help me get into the junior league someday. Still, the moment I walk in and smell those old people again and find them parked in the hallways like so many cars abandoned by the side of the road, I start begging God not to let me end up like this. But God is not a short-order cook, and these people were once my age. I bet they used to beg God not to let them end up as they have. At first, many of them look strangely alike, just as many people at the Special Olympics bear a familial resemblance to one another. Then you start to notice that some have lambskin chaps or blankets. Some have manicures. Some have the teeth they were born with. Some have sores. Some don't. Some were clearly beautiful in earlier days, some weren't. Some seem to know where they are, some remember lines from the Lord's Prayer, some sleep, some try to sing along on the simple hymns and clap in rhythm. But even the ones who clap all clap differently. Some clap along frailly, almost in silence. One woman claps with great gusto as if she's at a polka. One old man claps once as if to kill a fly. My favorite, a woman named Anne, like me, is someone I'd first pegged as a muzzy, emaciated woman who smelled of urine and baby powder without a whole lot going on inside. She isn't what I thought, though. I still don't know who she is, but I do know now who she isn't. She can never remember my name, and when I tell her every month, she pantomimes, smiting her own forehead. Then we both smile. I suspect she is pulling my leg. When we sing Amen, she always sits with her hands in her lap, palms cupped together as if there might be a tiny bird inside. With each clap, she moves her hands a tiny bit apart, as if she really does want to clap along, but at the same time she doesn't want to let the bird get out. If I'd written about her and the other old people after the first few visits, the smells and confusion would have dominated my description. I would have recorded our odd conversations. One woman is convinced we went to school together, another once asked if Sam was a dog, and I would have tried to capture my sense of waste. Instead, I continued to go there, and I struggled to find meaning in their bleak existence. What finally helped was an image from a medieval monk, Brother Lawrence, who saw all of us as trees in winter, with little to give, stripped of leaves and color and growth, whom God loves unconditionally anyway. My priest friend Margaret, who works with the aged and who shared this image with me, wanted me to see that even though these old people are no longer useful in any traditional meaning of the word, they are there to be loved unconditionally, like trees in the winter. When you write about your characters, we want to know all about their leaves and colors and growth. But we also want to know who they are when stripped of the surface show. So, if you want to get to know your characters, you have to hang out with them long enough to see beyond all the things they aren't. You may try to get them to do something because it would be convenient plot-wise, or you might want to pigeonhole them so you can maintain the illusion of control. But with luck, their tendrils will sneak out the sides of the box you put them in, and you'll finally have to admit that who they are isn't who you thought they were. Dying people can teach us this most directly. Often the attributes that define them drop away, the hair, the shape, the skills, the cleverness. And then it turns out that the packaging is not who that person has really been all along. Without the package, another sort of beauty shines through. For instance, on a retail therapy outing 10 days before she died, my friend Pammy discovered that she could no longer write her name on checks. And she turned to me and said, "What is the point of being alive when you can't even sign checks?" I could only shrug and shake my head. But it turned out that the essence of Pammy wasn't about the things she could do with her hands. Who she wasn't about doing at all. On the first anniversary of her death, I visited a memorial garden at the radiation clinic where she'd been treated and discovered that someone had planted a yew tree there in her honor. The yew was bigger than me and fuzzy, like an Edward Corrin character. It looked like it might suddenly come over and hug me. Near the yew were tall flowering bushes, some kind of poppy perhaps, but almost all of the petals had fallen off. So mostly I just saw 1,000 tangled stems growing skyward. Then I realized that the stems were actually connected and that they bore seeds that would flower again in the spring. That's how real life works, in our daily lives as well as in the convalescent home and even at the deathbed. And this is what good writing allows us to notice sometimes. You can see the underlying essence only when you strip away the busyness. And then some surprising connections appear. Plot treatment. My students assume that when well-respected writers sit down to write their books, they know pretty much what is going to happen, because they've outlined most of the plot. And this is why their books turn out so beautifully, and why their lives are so easy and joyful, their self-esteem so great, their childlike senses of trust and wonder so intact. Well, I do not know anyone fitting this description at all. Everyone I know flails around, kvetching and growing despondent, on the way to finding a plot and structure that work. You are welcome to join the club. On the other hand, in lieu of a plot, you may find that you have a sort of temporary destination, perhaps a scene that you envision as the climax. So, you write toward this scene, but when you get there, or close, you see that because of all you've learned about your characters along the way, it no longer works. The scene may have triggered the confidence that got you to work on your piece, but now it doesn't ring true, and so it does not make the final cut. I went through this process with my second novel, where an image kept me going while I came to have a strong sense of the people I was writing about. Yet, when it was the climactic image's turn on the dance floor, it was all wrong. So I got very quiet for a few days and waited for the characters to come to me with their lines and intentions. Gradually, I came to feel that I knew how the book ended, how it all hung together. By then, I had spent 2 solid years on the book, sending it off chunk by chunk to my editor at Viking. My editor had loved the characters all along, had loved the tone and the writing, but after reading my finished second draft straight through, he sent me back a letter that began, "This is perhaps the hardest letter I've ever had to write." I saw stars right there at the post office, as if someone had hit me on the head. The room spun. The editor went on to say that while he enjoyed the people and what they had to say, I had in effect created a beautiful banquet, but never invited the reader to sit down and eat. So the reader went hungry. And that, to mix metaphors, the book felt like a house with no foundation, no support beams, which was collapsing in on itself, and there was no way to shore it up. I should put it away and get to work on another book from scratch. The thing is, I had already spent most of the advance. I went into a very deep state of grief and fear at the post office, and this stuck with me for the next week or so. I was wild with humiliation and deeply afraid for my future. But I called someone who loved my writing, who had encouraged me all along, and she told me to give the book a little space, a little sunshine and fresh air. She said not to pick it up again for a month. She said that everything was going to be okay, although she did not know exactly what okay might look like. So I went off to the Elephant's Graveyard, renting a room in a huge old house on the Petaluma River. It was very quiet and pastoral. No one knew who I was, hardly anyone knew where I was. The meadows outside my windows were filled with cows and grass and hay. I licked my wounds for a couple of weeks and waited for my confidence to return. I tried not to make any big decisions about how to salvage the book or my writing life, because the one thing I knew for sure was that if you want to make God laugh, tell her your plans. Finally, I found myself ready to look at the book again. I read it through in one sitting and loved it. I thought it was wonderful. A huge mess, granted, but a wonderful mess. I called my editor and told him I knew what I was doing now and that I would prove this to him. He was genuinely happy. There was a huge dilapidated living room in the house where I lived, and one more.